Hello, this is Mike Senyu with HMTRI. This is conference call number 20 in our PLC series. It's May 12th, 2010. To tell you a little bit about these series of professional learning communities, we have this is our second cycle. Every 2 weeks, we hold a conference session on various topics of interest, all related to starting, developing, and sustaining a successful Brownfields job training program. Each week, we take up a different topic. We have a tentative agenda of those topics, and then that may vary depending on the interest of the group. This particular week, we're talking about working with the community. The topics so far have been issues such as funding sources in the past, recruitment, placement, health and safety. In the future, we'll be talking about certifications, student recruitment and assessment, placement tracking, program startup. Next week, we're going to be talking about program scope and definition, defining green jobs and how that fits into your program. This particular MP3 podcast is a recreation of the May 12th session. We had some technical difficulties and we weren't able to download this particular session. So I'm going to go over the poignant issues that we talked about during that session so that we can post this on our website, and plus anyone who calls in who missed that session can listen to the basic overall topics, and if they have questions they can post them to the group and we'll have the discussions. Essentially, when we talk about partnering and working with the community, we're not really talking about marketing. We're really talking about establishing relationships with people around us in our community that can provide us potential resources, or that we may partner in a way that combining with them makes both programs stronger, that helps in various aspects of our program. Working with the community is definitely essential to having this entire system sustainable. I like to divide it into four major topic areas in terms of working with the community. The first one is establishing relationships with existing job development and training programs, essentially finding who's out there, doing a scan of the community to see what programs that might be similar to ours are out there and how they're doing and what kind of job they're doing. The second is looking and coordinating with existing training organizations, community colleges, universities, trade schools, that type of organization. The third is coordinating with our local organized labor organizations. Some of us live in right-to-work states, others not. If they're federal facilities, we likely have union representation no matter where we're at. It's, and we'll go into this later, quite important that we work with labor organizations whose mission is training and health and safety and protection of their workers. And then finally, linking to the environmental activity in our community. What's going on. And clearly, if we're going to provide trained, certified workers to these activities, we need to be in communications with them, perhaps even partnership with them, to relate their program to what we're training and our training to their program. So let's go over these one by one in a little bit more detail. And see what we're talking about. When we talk about relationships with existing job development and training programs, we're essentially doing a scan. We want to scan our community and see what is out there. There, for example, are many Job Corps programs that were developed in the 70s and 80s through Department of Labor funds. They established job training programs all over the country. They were quite extensive and fairly successful. They've established over the years mature programs that include recruitment of personnel, screening of potential participants, the assessment of them, of course, the training, the placement. They've established life skills training and also methods and mechanisms for tracking students after they've been placed. Many of these programs dried up when Job Corps has been reorganized several times. Some of them have taken on different identities. Some of them are called, they might be called one-stop career centers that they've migrated into. Others might be opportunity career centers, OAI, Job Corps centers, or job service centers. These are basically different names under different funding mechanisms that have evolved from the original Job Corps programs. And if there is one in your community, it's definitely worth and important that you get in contact with them for several reasons. They traditionally, when they were organized, they did not include green jobs or environmental jobs, and they may not now, but many of them may have evolved and added additional training and may include environmental jobs or jobs that would be relevant to setting up a Brownfields job training program. The other thing is they may bring all of the things together that you may or may not have. In other words, they may bring together those life skills components that you would perhaps find difficult to start up in a Brownfields green job training program with EPA funding, for example, which does not cover life skills training. They would have those mechanisms in place and would be an excellent partner for you to work with. Job Corps centers are certainly one avenue. There are a host of others. You may find in your scan of the existing training programs, an NIEHS training program that existed at one time or exists now. You may find an NIEHS programs, which we'll talk about later in our series, are funded programs through NIEHS, National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, which concentrates on health and safety training and green jobs, I would say, a sister program to the Brownfield Green Jobs Training Program. You may find in your community there's one of these programs, which you would definitely want to coordinate with and not duplicate efforts with, and certainly not compete with. They're programs that can be compatible. If you do have one near you, they can assist each other. Indeed, some of our grantees receiving EPA funds have NIEHS programs and also have applied for Brownfield job training programs. So the fact is there may be one of these programs. There may be many weatherization programs in your area. And this is something that we will probably talk about in more detail later. There has been considerable amount of money through the Department of Labor and Pathways Out of Poverty and also ARA funds through stimulus that have gone into communities and worked their way into weatherization programs, providing weatherization to low-income housing through HUD properties, through city-administered programs. As a result, there have been quite a few programs starting up that are training weatherization personnel. There's a little bit of concern in our discussions that with so many programs starting and money coming down the pike for these programs, that there are people starting up programs, training people, and the jobs may not be there yet because the actual infrastructure money, the installation of weatherization has not gotten to the street yet. And basically, we have to be careful to ensure that there aren't too many training programs in an area and that there is a supply and of personnel to meet the demand, but not that there's an oversupply and there is no demand. So I think, again, it's very important to scan your area to see what's there. If there are, for example, many weatherization programs coming up in the next 3 or 4 months, you may want to rethink whether or not you want to go into weatherization, and you may want to stay with traditional environmental remediation jobs, for example. This also goes hand in hand with doing your needs assessment. We always emphasize how important it is to do a local needs assessment. In a way, you could say this is working with the community. You are finding out what local industries are there, what their needs are, and your mission basically are to fill those needs. And we'll talk a little bit about this later when we talk about linking to environmental sites and activities. So essentially, we've done a scan. We see what kind of training programs are out there. Some are like yours that you're proposing, or some may not be like yours but have similar aspects. At this point, you can see the potential for partnering with some of these programs, that they have things that you don't have. You may even want to combine your proposed program with theirs and expand their program rather than starting a program from scratch. So essentially, we're doing that. There's a URL that in post-session notes we've posted. It's called www.jobcorps.gov/centers. If you go to jobcorps.gov, it'll give you locations of the existing job training program associated with Job Corps, Department of Labor. The second part of working with the community is partnering with the local training organizations in your area. And what do I mean by local training organizations? I'm basically talking about universities, community colleges, trade schools, professional schools, perhaps even high schools. This would also include organized labor training, which we're going to talk about next, because that is also a key component in working with the community. But what we want to do, similar to what we did in terms of scanning to existing job development programs, we want to scan the community and see what type of training is going on. And some of us may be thinking of developing a job training program, but we are hesitant because we're not technical experts. We're not engineers, or we're not teachers. So we may not know about the technical aspects of green jobs. We're more project managers, or we feel we can organize, we'd like to organize one of these, but a little hesitant about going into a technical area. And that doesn't necessarily have to be a deal killer to keep you from organizing this. Project management skills are key to this. And when we look at job training programs, actually the technical training is just one of about 6 or 7 components that make a successful program. All these other ancillary things that to make it sustainable and make it work also need to be done. So the fact is that if you have skills in all the areas, you need to go out and seek your technical experts. And how do we do that? Well, one might think, well, I have to hire technical experts or trainers and have them on my staff, and this is going to be too expensive. There's no way I could keep within my budget to have a staff of technical people. That may be a goal you'll want to work towards, but when you're starting up, the other answer is let's partner. Let's partner with the local community college, which has experts, is working with industry already, perhaps providing some courses in the areas you want to train to. The people have experience. They're excellent at what they do. You can tap into that resource by partnering with the local community college. it may be a local university. We often find through our experience universities are focusing on the more academic issues related to environmental technology. They might be looking at heat transfer issues and looking at the more abstract concepts of engineering and not necessarily the applications or the vocational aspects of environmental and energy issues, but they may. There are some colleges who tend to focus more on vocational and application types of programs, and then as we migrate towards the more universities that are research-oriented, they go towards the more abstract issues. The larger universities, research institutions, can provide experts and technical experts that could supplement your programs, provide lectures on very specific issues or research they're doing or very technical issues they're doing in terms of training a target population. While they may not be the best candidate, they can be part of a teaching team that might work very well. Certainly don't turn off the universities because you may indeed find professors at those schools who are very down to earth and are really excited about working with community, working with underserved populations, and are very training oriented. And so definitely contact university first or second. Absolutely contact the community college. Community colleges are what community colleges, the name implies. They provide training and education to meet community needs. And actually, that's what we're doing here. We're providing education and training to residents of the community. Indeed, community colleges are often broken down into credit and non-credit, so that the credit side of the shop maybe a little more like university students who are interested in going on to higher education may take 2 years, math and science and English, and laying a firm foundation to articulate into more advanced studies, getting an associate degree and then moving on to a four-year and master's PhD program. But they also provide vocational training, associate degrees, and just basic training, often in the non-credit side of the course, which are vocational skills that provide the education and training to people who need jobs now, who need specific skills. And in fact, some community colleges, they have a reverse pyramid where people may have a PhD and have a high degree of abstract or technical education, but they need to go on a waste site, and they need a HAZWOPR certificate, and they can't get it at their university, so they go to the community college where they can actually get specific hands-on training to get certificates that allow them to go on a waste site or work with asbestos or with lead or RMP. So indeed, we actually see often a university partnering with a community college to get the community college training. And community colleges have people on their staff, both on credit and non-credit, and they may be different. The credit people may be more interested in academic programs. Non-credit may be more interested in the types of program you're trying to establish, the training type of program. They may be people from business and industry. They may be consultants who are working part-time as instructors. In any case, it's an excellent resource because, one, they have full-time jobs or they're working already in business and industry or with the community colleges, and they could partner with you to provide your training. They're not your full-time employees. They're your partners. They might be hired by your program as a consultant. You may consult with them and use them as you need them for your courses. You may partner with the college so they would provide you with the instructional staff as you need it. So there are various ways to go. And I would definitely go to the community college, go to the chancellor's office at first and decide and find out if you need to work with the academic side, which is the credit side, or the non-credit side or business and industry, or both. See where the people that you might need and the training you might need best fit, and then start talking to these instructors. And the other thing about community colleges, and when I say community colleges, I think I need to also talk about trade schools. There's many, many vocational trade schools out there that would be in a similar situation. Some might be private or for-profit schools. They may not have exactly the same mission statement or goals that a publicly funded community college would have, but they might also be interested and use the technical expertise that you need. But in both cases, the trade school, for-profit vocational education institution, or the community college, when you get to the instructor level, often they will have a wealth of information that are going to help you in all sorts of community relations. They're going to tell you who the major contractors are in the area, because they've probably worked with them already. If they've had a lot of experience, they've worked with the people who need the remediation done. They may have worked with the state and government agencies. And in fact, many of our Brownfields grantees are community colleges who have applied for grants and received them. So clearly, scanning the training organizations to see what's out there, what's available for you, will help you piece together your Brownfields training program without having to bring all these people on staff. The last thing I had mentioned in terms of scanning training organizations is to contact local labor unions, organized labor. The mission of organized labor is worker rights, worker health and protection, worker safety, training. These are all the key elements of why we have organized labor and the appeal to organized labor to their constituents. Clearly, depending on where you are, if you're in an urban industrialized area, organized labor may have a larger influence on the workforce. If you're in the traditionally less industrialized areas in the south, southeast, there may not be as much organized labor. There may be some. There may be organized labor organizations that are working associated with federal facilities. But in any case, it's probably a good thing to contact them. More important, if you're in industrialized northern area where organized labor is strong, you definitely need to work with them. As you go to the right-to-work states and they're less of an influence, they may not have the facilities in the community that you're working in, but you need to contact them because they may be able to partner with you in different ways. Labor unions have been really significant and helpful and positive in some of our Brownfields job training grant programs. They've not only provided training facilities, training instructors, training curriculum. They've also partnered in an informal way where they've taken participants who have graduated and made a pathway into their apprenticeship program. Some have given them fast tracks into their apprenticeship program, which essentially means someone going through your program in a highly organized labor situation can get a backdoor into the labor union. Sometimes some of the programs are able to subsidize initiation fees, for example, to get in the union. So they've been extremely helpful and very cooperative. I think that sometimes, occasionally, we'll run into situations where we're in an industrial area where there's high unemployment, similar to what we're experiencing now. There are many laborers on the bench looking for jobs. And, of course, a new jobs development program that goes in and says we want to generate more people and we want to put more people in your organization. While labor organizations want as many people as they can in their program, they have to think twice about, and do we want another person sitting on the bench? Or how are our constituents going to look at us promoting a program that, while they're unemployed and sitting on a bench, bring more people into that area. So you have to be very careful, and you have to frame this in the proper context. You're really training people in a very specific area. If it's weatherization, if it's lead or asbestos removal, RRP, they may have people sitting on the bench, but they may not be people who are trained in lead or in asbestos or radon, or they may not have a 40-hour waste-site worker training. They may not necessarily be green workers. They may not be trained in these occupations, and they may not have a training program available in that community. So they may welcome your program, and in fact, they may take your program and want to partner with you to help train some of their existing employees who are on the bench. They may work with you to upgrade the competency or educational level of the people that are on the bench or unemployed. So clearly, touching base with them is a positive thing. I think you'll always warmly be received, whether or not they're in a position to help you, either with resources or finances or facilities, which often we've seen organized labor donate or provide in-kind support in terms of facilities, health and safety facilities, for example. To the extent that they will partner with you is something that you need to find out. The question is, okay, which labor unions do you want to partner with? And, of course, this will depend on your curriculum. It'll depend on the types of training you're doing. If you're doing weatherization, there is a labor union that is insulators that you may want to work with. If you're doing solar panels, you may want to work with the electricians union. If you're working with asbestos, you might be working with the plumbers union, plumbers and fitters. This is associated with asbestos on around piping. You may work with laborers or transportation workers. If you're working with lead, you may be working with the carpenters or painters. So clearly that would depend on your particular curriculum and the area of emphasis that you're going to be talking about. The best way to find organized labor organizations is just going to Google. Google organized labor near and then your community. In my case, I live in Raleigh, North Carolina, right to work state. I can just Google labor organizations near Raleigh, North Carolina, and a list of all of the prominent organizations come up with contact information. I can call them up and ask them if they're doing anything in green jobs. If it's electrical, are they doing anything with solar? Do they have any training program? Can we get together and talk? This is the kind of program I'm thinking of starting. If it's if I'm doing lead removal, RRP, I might contact the Carpenters and Painters Union, say, do you have any programs currently? They might give you an idea of the job market, what opportunities are here, what kind of training they have, or if they have none, they might be interested in the type of program I would be setting up and working with me in that way. So clearly, organized labor is a key component of working with the community. So we've talked about so far scanning the area for existing job development programs. We've talked about partnering with local community colleges, universities, trade schools to see who's doing training that we can use their resources. We've dovetailed that into working and coordinating with organized labor organizations that may be a source of training, facilities, job placement, recruitment, working with them. So we've got a complete system. Linking with environmental sites and activities remains another of the key issues. This is, of course, what we're all about. We're basically providing training to participants of the community who are essentially stakeholders because they live there, but we want to give them jobs in the community. So by definition, we have to really do a scan of the community. This is our basic needs assessment. See who's out there, what they're doing, what kind of environmental activity is there. Is it possible we live in a community where there's no environmental activity going on? There's nothing happening. There's no industrialization. There are no factories or no polluters or no need for insulation. I don't know. That's a possibility. In all likelihood, every community's got some sort of issue, whether it's a weatherization issue, a conservation issue, a pollution environmental issue with industry, or people want to be green and they want to start installing geothermal or wind or solar. One of the key things is, and we always tell everyone, the first thing you do is a needs assessment. And this is essentially a needs assessment, but what we're talking about is finding out what's going on there, what's going on in your community. And from an environmental point of view, there are some easy ways of doing that. You can now go to EPA resources. And in the post-session notes, I provide the link to that. It's called, it's a way of searching your environment by zip code. And the program is called Cleanups in My Community. And if you type in Google Cleanups in My Community, it'll get you there. They've changed the URL of that site. It's http://iaspub.epa.gov/cleanups. In the post-session notes, I've got that link that you can look up. But Cleanups in My Community basically will give you, by zip code, you type in your zip code and sites, facilities, and properties that have been contaminated by hazardous materials and are being or have been cleaned up by either the Superfund program in EPA, RCRA, and or brownfields cleanup. It also has federal facilities that have been contaminated by hazardous materials and are being or have been cleaned up under the EPA Superfund or RCRA program. This is a great resource to find out, is there a brownfield in your area? Is there a Superfund or a RCRA site? Are there cleanups going on? So the first cut would be basically going to Cleanups in My Community, finding out where are sites environmental in your community to see if you've got anything going on in terms of EPA or state activity, putting your zip code in. And that'll give you a listing of all of the facilities in your area. It's great. It'll give you contact information, everything you need that will work in terms of doing a needs assessment so that you can go to these companies and see what type of need there is for personnel, what contractors they're using, do they need people, do they need certain certifications, can you work with them, can you partner with them, how can you... Is there a demand for trained people locally? So you can find from the environmental point of view exactly what's needed. If you want to go beyond that, you can also go to an EPA, another EPA site, search your environment by zip code. And there are several, and again, I'll put the URL in the post-session notes, but it's www.epa.gov/EPAHON, and it's basically search your environment by zip code, and you can Google that, and it'll get you there, and you put in your five-digit zip code, and basically it'll bring you into My Environment homepage, which is a information and maps about your local, very similar to Cleanup in My Community, but a little more comprehensive. EnviroFacts, which is it's pollution, hazardous waste sites, and other regulatory information. That's EnviroFacts. It'll give you access to the toxic release inventory, which is potential chemical releases in your neighborhood. They may not be a Superfund site necessarily, but they're potential toxic releases. Facilities registry system. These are a search of all the facilities, sites, or places that are subject to environmental regulations. It's an incredible registry. Again, when you're talking about doing a local needs assessment, you don't necessarily want to do a massive survey that no one's going to respond to, but you want to find out who the potential polluters are that would need your service and start contacting them and seeing what the needs are, who their contractors are, contact information if they're hiring internally, and they might hire your people. That's the it's a time-saving approach where you're not only making that contact with a potential employer, but you're also doing your needs assessment. At the same time, you're establishing people who may be on your advisory committee, which we're going to talk about at a later date. You're also establishing the need for your program and also direction of how and what kind of training people you should be, what kind of training you should be doing. The other thing that Search for Your Environment by Zip Code provides you is enforcement and compliance histories, which is great. Facility inspections and any enforcement actions. So basically, EPA over the years has established an incredible database of everything environmental in your community, very specific to your zip code, of what's going on and what kind of environmental issues there may be in your community, what kind of who the players are, who you need to contact. And this is all a part of working with the community. And you want to work with these industrial employers, potential employers, or potential polluters, because these will be the people who need the people that you're going to be developing. And also you have to know what kind of people you need to be developing, what kind of people they're hiring, and what their constraints are. That's in the environmental side. In the energy side, when we start talking about other green jobs that may not be environmental remediation, weatherization and energy, now we're doing a little bit different kind of scan. Now these aren't people that have any history of environmental degradation or releases or Superfund or brownfields. We're now talking about conservation and installation of energy-saving instruments. And it's a much broader area, and that you might have to dig a little bit more because there aren't necessarily the inventories that EPA has established on that side. We're now talking about solar installers, roofing installers who may be putting in solar, electrical contractors who are moving into the solar area. There may be some wind facilities. There are selected cities that have factories and firms that are associated with developing wind-associated energy infrastructure. And they may be hiring a very specific type of person that you would have to train in conjunction with them to meet certain needs that they have to do wind. Often we find that associated with wind turbines, we're talking about traditional occupations in terms of mechanics and machinists and engineers, electricians, who are basically putting parts together, and just so happens that the end result of this is going to be a wind turbine and tower installers. Those are traditional occupations, but they may need some particular type of training that you could suit to fit them. In terms of weatherization contractors, we're talking about your traditional construction contractors. They're maybe some additional training there. There would be also inspectors that would require certifications and certain specific training in weatherization. Auditors to determine to the extent that a home needs weatherization and what type of weatherization it needs. That does require specific training. You have to make sure, though, that there is a job and who those people would be that would be hiring your students at the end of the training. So when you're going into this type of training, you have to be very careful. I think you have to identify first the job and the type of training required to do that job. And then you train to that job and the needs of those jobs so that when they come through, they know a place where they can go to get this job, not just create a curriculum and then push you out the door and good luck. You definitely need to identify those companies and those industries or governmental agencies that we're going to be hiring those people and need to have a firm footing on the numbers of people they're going to be needing. And, of course, if you did your scan of existing training programs earlier, make sure that there's not someone else that's already generating more people than they're going to need. So clearly you've got to identify those people. That insulation activity, a weatherization activity, is quite important. The same in terms of lead RRP. If you're going to be doing lead removal, say you're going to be doing painting or replacement of windows, even associated with weatherization, you may need RRP. You may need confined space certifications if you're working on some enclosed spaces on whether it's solar or other type geothermal or one of the other energy green jobs. Those specific certifications, you may need to provide them as part of your training program. I think the question that you need to ask yourself is if you're doing painting, lead paint removal, you need to talk to the painting contractors. And also, if you're in an area where not a lot of lead paint was used, your newer areas, in my community, Raleigh, which is fairly new post lead paint construction, there's not as much lead paint around, mostly in older facilities that may have already been renovated. There may not be as big a demand as there would be in a city like Chicago or Boston or New York, where we've got lots of lead paint, or Charleston, South Carolina, where there are very historic communities. Residences have lots of lead paint, and it really becomes an issue. So, again, you can get a good feel for the need for people with lead certifications, and if the painters in the community have those certifications, and the contractors that are doing the work, if they have the certifications, then you may very well find that having done a scan of the activity in your area, that there's a lot of lead paint or no lead paint removal or asbestos removal. There is a demand in your area that you could train to if you provide specific training. So essentially, we've gone through all of the components, the four major ones in terms of community partnering, working with community, and the developing the relationships. There is the very biggest one, which we haven't talked about, is basically working with community awareness. This is the general community, and this is a big enough topic we'll talk about in a separate session, working with community organizations, working with churches, neighborhoods, community relationships in that sense. Also, of course, working with your governmental organizations becomes a key factor. We always indicate to people that they need to work first with the federal level. If they're working with a EPA Brownfields job training program, for example, they need to contact the regional office. EPA and most federal agencies work on a regional basis. The country is divided into 10 regions, and then each region covers about 5 states. In the case of Brownfields job training, each region has a job training coordinator. The best way to find that coordinator is to go to the website of the region, go to, say, EPA Region 4, and search for the Brownfields job training coordinator. And Kathleen Curry's name will come up, and you can contact Kathleen. It'll give you contact information. And this is definitely a must. Anyone starting a program, we always ask them to first talk to the regional coordinator. Let them know you're interested in starting a program. They're going to be very encouraging and help you as much as they can. to get a program started. They could give you valuable information on any programs that are currently in your community, what opportunities are going to be around for funding, and they could nurture you along to some extent in terms of providing you with a grant assistance in terms of how you need to write that grant. And until the RFP comes out, they can give you quite a bit of assistance. The next level, of course, is your state. You need to contact your state. While they will not have a job training coordinator, they will have a brownfields coordinator in the state, and you need to touch base with them and tell them what you're doing. They may not be as familiar with job training, but they will be quite familiar with brownfields, and you need to coordinate with them, and that's essential in terms of identifying the brownfields and the environmental activity that's happening in your community. And stay in close touch with them, and of course you're going to want to coordinate with them if you're writing any sort of grant that they're in the loop in terms of your job training program. I think the most important state, city, government, state and local is our key. You need to contact your local environmental or health department because they will be the ones that know what's going on, who the contractors are, what kind of enforcement actions are occurring, what sort of inspections are going on. And they would be very familiar with your local situation. Now, depending on the size of your community, the local environmental department may be very small, or it may be very large. If you live in Los Angeles or Chicago or Boston, you may have a very large local agency. That agency may have been combined into a state agency, in which case you'd work very closely with the state agency and the people assigned to your locality. You also not only have to talk to the EPA people, but when it involves emissions and remediation, it would be EPA, but when it involves, say, lead or particularly energy, we're bringing other agencies into it. You might be working with the health department, for example, state health department or OSHA. You may be working with, in the case of lead in many states, handling it through HUD or the health department, the housing or health. If it's certainly weatherization, you're going to be working perhaps with HUD, Housing Urban Development, or you may be working with some economic development agency, or you may be working with an energy agency. So clearly, you're going to have to do, depending on your particular locale, you're going to have to do some digging and finding out what is the are the key agencies, and you'll be maybe working with multiple agencies in your program, some for weatherization, some for lead, and some for environmental remediation, and of course, working with those communities. So I think we've covered the bases. Again, we'll probably talk in more detail about the public awareness in your community in terms of working with schools and churches and working with community organizations at a later date. We've talked about working with the organized labor, federal government, state government, local government, community colleges, organized labor, and, of course, the people that need the services, whether it's the private sector or federal sector that are either emitting things that need to be controlled or need cleanup work or doing contracting services. So essentially, that is the kind of the gist of what we talked about in session 20, which is working with the community. The next session we're going to have will be May 26th, and we'll be talking about the program scope and definition, establishing advisory committees and getting your program started, and the types of jobs that you may want to include in your program. So until we talk to you again, appreciate you listening to this. And if you want to join our PLC, our professional learning community, you could email me, msenyu@aol.com, or glow at hmtrighanne@eicc.edu. Just tell them you want to join the PLC, and we'll get you into our weekly 30-minute conference call and post-session notes. Until then, we hope you have a good couple of weeks, and then we'll talk to you soon in a couple of weeks. Thank you.